It is Back to the Future on energy and climate policy after Prime Minister Scott Morrison handed emissions reduction duties to the Energy Minister, Angus Taylor, in his weekend reshuffle. The move reverses his decision to split energy from climate change just 9 months ago. Here he is explaining the decision.
If you look closely at the Climate Solutions Fund and the other initiatives that are related to actually meeting our emissions reductions targets. I mean, it's Snowy 2.0, it's the Mariner Sleek, the Battery of the Nation project. These projects fall very much into the role of energy infrastructure that Angus is closely associated with. And so it made, I think, a lot of sense to be able to bring that under the same banner.
That's the Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, speaking there. The Coalition was keen to promote its plans to build new infrastructure to strengthen the energy grid during the election campaign, spruiking projects, as we heard there, like Snowy 2.0, as well as the interconnector with Tasmania. Andrew Dillon is the Chief Executive of Energy Networks Australia. He represents the companies which run the electricity poles, wires and pipes across the nation. Welcome back to Breakfast.
Good morning, Hamish.
Scott Morrison says there won't be any major changes to his emissions policies. How do you read that decision to remarry energy and emissions reduction under the one minister?
Well, first of all, I think right across the sector, we welcome the move to put energy and emissions reductions back together. There's no question that the key challenge in the energy space is how do we manage the transition to a low emissions generation fleet while keeping the lights on and keeping power bills down.
The government's pushing several projects, including the Snowy 2.0 pumped hydro storage, as well as Tasmania's so-called Battery of the Nation, and with that a second interconnector linking Tasmania to the mainland. Are these projects, in your view, actually going to help stabilise the grid?
Yeah, well, one of the things we have seen is last year, according to the Clean Energy Council, we had 2.3 gigawatts of renewables connect to the grid around the country. So that, to put that in context, the Liddell Power Station, that's often talked about, is less than 2 gigawatts. And there's another 50 or 60-odd projects in the pipeline right now. Some have been connected since then. So we're seeing a massive investment in solar and in wind right across the country. And what that's starting to mean, and it's still a transition, is that we will have times when it is sunny and it's windy and we have an awful lot of electrons. But it also means when there are times when it is dark and it is still, when we're having some challenges. And so what we need there is both generation and transmission links to fill in those gaps so we can get more what they call dispatchable energy, we can get better connections across the country, around the world. The response to this move to more renewable generation is being linked to a desire to be more and more connected. So it certainly makes sense at a high level to be looking at things like Battery of the Nation in Tasmania and a second interconnection, to be looking at projects like Snowy and how the transmission links work around that, to be looking at, as we're already seeing, we're almost underway, a new interconnector between South Australia and New South Wales. And this all makes sense as part of a transforming sector.
It may make sense, but does it achieve that objective? I mean, does that give us the reliability we are told we need as a nation?
What we need is generation and transmission that can fill in some of those gaps. And pumped hydro is not the only answer. Right. But again, certainly it is seen in many areas as a potential way to be able to pump that water back uphill when we have lots of electrons and then to be able to use it to fill in those gaps. It's not the only solution. Batteries will play a role. Interconnection will play a role. Gas peaking generation is bound to play a role as we do this. We need a variety of options and we need to be looking across the board to get many measures to make it work.
This is going to be a suite of measures. I mean, how close are we to achieving this? That's what I think probably many of our listeners this morning would like to understand.
Well, the challenge we have here is sometimes presented as a black and white and we're starting and we're finished. This is a long transition. I think it'll be decades before you could even remotely say we are finished. We have coal generators in Australia that are due to retire over the next two or three decades. So it's making sure as they retire, we have enough generation to replace them and to potentially meet new demand from things like electric vehicles. And we have the right grid connections right across the country to make sure that those electrons can get to market.
What about the integration of the small and large scale renewables like rooftop solar, wind and hydro? Is that, we know that's a key challenge. Is that part of this?
Certainly, it's very, very connected. What we're seeing now is over 2 million Australian homes have solar panels on their roofs. And that's great news for those people who are generating their own electricity. It's good news from an emissions reductions perspective. But from a local network point of view, it's creating all sorts of challenges that these grids were never designed for. We're starting to see negative flows. If you think of it like a water pipe, everyone's pumping water back into the local water pipes and water's flowing backwards, which it was never designed to do. And it can do that, but it is a significant challenge of how do we work it during those peak times, which we're going to see on spring sunny days, and to get to the stage where we decide, do we spend more in our networks to allow more people to connect, but without, again, spending too much and putting everyone's bills up, and who should pay for that?
Josh Frydenberg, the Treasurer, has done an interview with Guardian Australia talking about the creation of renewable energy zones and ensuring that we have the transmission and distribution networks to match it. What does that look like in practice?
What it will tend to look like, indeed, some see the Battery of the Nation we're talking about as one of them, but example, somewhere like Broken Hill in New South Wales, where it's exceptionally sunny and there's potential for a significant amount of solar in particular, but also potentially wind generation. But at the moment, that's nowhere near the grid. So how do we determine if that is what we might be dubbing this renewable energy zone? How do we focus on it? How do we determine what grid connections we need to link that zone? And most importantly, how do we pay for that? How do we set up the investment framework to make sure the grid connection is bankable, but then also what's the right priority for how it's paid off over time?
So, I mean, how many of these zones would we be talking about across Australia in the longer term?
Again, in the longer term, we'll be talking about quite a few. The market operator, AEMO, put out what they call the Integrated System Plan in the middle of last year, and it identified numerous zones right across the national electricity market, which runs from right down the eastern coast and includes South Australia. But again, we won't be developing them all at once. It is about how we do this phased transition as we move from a largely coal-based generation fleet to more and more renewables.
You mentioned the move towards electric cars earlier in this conversation. How much additional capacity are we going to need on the grid to support that kind of motoring future?
Again, on the grid, it's all about timing. One of the challenges we don't want to see, Hamish, is we have people who start to buy electric vehicles en masse, and on those really hot summer afternoons, because that's when most of the country's grids are under particular stress, people come home, plug in their electric vehicle, walk inside and turn on an air conditioner. But that's something we can easily avoid. We need to get smarts in how home charging happens. We need to encourage people both by technology and by pricing signals. They might plug their car in when they get home, but there's some smarts in there that know that they don't charge at peak times and they start charging at 9 o'clock at night or whatever it is. So if we get that as we do this electric vehicle rollout, what we hope...
Do I interpret it correctly from what you're saying, that we don't necessarily need a great deal more capacity, that this is about technology that sort of tapers the usage of it over time?
Yes, I mean, again, if we get significant take-up of electric vehicles, we will need new capacity. But if it's done well, that will overall lead to more load on the system using the same poles and wires. And if we can get that working, that means lower costs for everyone. So that is something we want to see. We see electric vehicles as a significant opportunity. It is difficult to set targets for this sort of thing. It's a little bit like trying to set targets for take-up of the iPhone. It'll be customer preferences and customer demand that drive the take-up of electric vehicles. But what we need to do is the grid and the planners for the grid make sure that when that take-up starts to kick up, we have the capacity ready and we have the smarts to put in people's homes with their charging.
Andrew Dillon, thank you very much.
Thanks, Hamish.
Andrew Dillon is the Chief Executive of Energy Networks Australia.